From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. The 28th Annual Everglades Coalition Conference kicks off this week in Coral Gables. The event brings together stakeholders on the local, state, and national level working together on efforts to preserve and restore Florida's River of Grass. Ahead, we'll explore some recent environmental restoration successes, as well as challenges and opportunities that lie ahead for Everglades advocates. Plus, emerging nanotechnology is poised to bring about revolutionary changes to our lives, but when it comes to research and development on potentially harmful nanoparticles, little regulation exists. That issue is at the crux of the latest novel from best-selling author, physician, and Naples resident Robin Cook. We'll talk with Cook about his latest medical thriller, Nano. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. As the science of nanotechnology progresses, resulting agencies, or regulating agencies rather, like the EPA and the Food and Drug Administration, have begun considering the potential risks of nanoparticles in what has so far been a largely unregulated branch of research. Developments in nanotechnology, human experiments, and the lack of regulatory controls are at the heart of the latest novel from physician, writer, and part-time Naples resident Robin Cook. Coming up later in today's show, WGCU's Amy Tardiff sits down with Cook for a look at his medical thriller titled Nano. But first, the 28th Annual Everglades Coalition Conference kicks off tomorrow in Coral Gables. The coalition is a consortium of more than 50 local, state, and national organizations dedicated to the protection and restoration of Florida's River of Grass. The conference brings together stakeholders to highlight successful restoration projects already in the works, as well as look at challenges, opportunities, and threats facing the health of the Everglades in the years ahead. We'll take a closer look at projects, studies, and strategies that will be explored at this year's conference, as well as examine the health of the Everglades ecosystem now and why, regardless of our level of interest, we're all stakeholders in the health of the Everglades. Joining me now is State Co-Chair of the Everglades Coalition Conference, Jennifer Hecker. She's also Director of Natural Resource Policy at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida in Collier County. Jennifer Hecker, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. It's great to speak with you again.
Well, thank you for having us.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. What would you like to see come out of this year's annual Everglades Coalition Conference? The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Jennifer, just to start off, the theme of last year's conference was Everglades Worth Every Penny. Tell us about the theme of this year's conference and what that reflects.
Well, this year's conference theme is America's Everglades, Our Legacy, Our Future. And it's really an opportunity to look back and look forward and try to figure out how we can bring this restoration project to its conclusion. It was originally envisioned to be completed in 20 years, and the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan was passed in 2000. So we're far along on the path of that 20-year plan, and we want to make sure that we're making timely progress to bring it to conclusion in a timely manner so that we can reap the benefits.
Will the theme of concentrating on the economic value of conservation lands continue this year, both at the conference and in your policy and advocacy work?
Yes. Last year, we had a very prominent study released that showed that for every dollar invested in the Everglades, you got a $4 return on that investment. And this year, we'll have additional studies by economists to talk about the value of water quality specifically and other benefits that are going to be the result of Everglades restoration. So we continue to highlight that there is a direct economic benefit to our state in the form of tourism, waterfront real estate values, and a host of other services that are being provided by the Everglades Restoration Project.
I remember we touched on that when we spoke after last year's conference. It's just an incredible figure, a 4-to-1 return on the investment. Where does that come from? Is that, do you think, with the Everglades primarily with water?
Absolutely. One of the biggest challenges we have here in South Florida is the lack of adequate, clean, fresh water. And there has been a 70% decrease in flow through the Everglades. By restoring it, we're going to increase our freshwater supply to sustain our current population and to allow additional growth into the future. So that will help our economic development here in South Florida.
And the current issue of water quality and nutrient pollution in Florida – I mean, that's a legal battle that's been going on since 1998, I think. What can you tell us, or can you tell us a little bit about just kind of a quick update on what has been going on back and forth with the lawsuit, to where we stand now, you know, what has gone into effect and what can we expect to go into effect in 2013 regarding pollution controls?
Well, nutrients, excess phosphorus and nitrogen are two of the primary pollutants that are degrading the Everglades, as well as degrading all of our waters, including our estuaries and our beaches, and causing those ugly slime outbreaks and those fish kills. And so we are really trying to control that. There was a monumental step this past year with the state and the federal government working together to create a new Everglades water quality plan that will hopefully address some of the problems directly affecting the Everglades. But of course, we need to look at all the pollution input coming into the greater Everglades system from outside of the Everglades. And that is something we're still struggling with. And that's the subject of ongoing litigation, which our organization and other organizations are involved with, trying to make sure that we have meaningful, effective nutrient pollution water quality standards that will help control this pollution in the future and make sure that it doesn't undo all of the good work that our restoration projects are doing in cleaning up our waters and restoring our quality of life.
And late last year, Jennifer, the EPA, in a decision that was hailed as one of the most significant changes to water resource regulation in Florida since the Clean Water Act, filed a notice in federal court approving the state DEP's numeric nutrient criteria in lieu of the federal agency's own proposed rules. Was that a decision that you were happy with? Was there much of a difference between what had been proposed by the state and what had been proposed by the feds?
There was a very significant difference. And in fact, the Everglades Coalition did take a formal position on this, which is available on our website, which said that we opposed the state standards because we felt they were too weak, that they weren't going to result in more control of this nutrient pollution. And that was sorely needed. The EPA standards were much stronger and were going to actually produce some water quality improvements. So we were disappointed that the EPA would approve the state's rules. Those only apply to 15% of Florida's waters, however. And EPA did propose standards of its own for the other remaining 85%. So the majority of Florida's waters currently are being protected under very stringent EPA standards. There will be hearings next week in Tampa on Thursday and Friday, where EPA is going to be gathering public input on those standards. And we're going to be there to show strong support for EPA keeping those strong standards in place.
Okay. So that's 85% of the waters. That's a victory, I would say, from
we
your
end. We feel
that
that's a victory. We're going to have to work hard to keep that victory. There's already talk about the state trying to propose standards to act as a surrogate for those. We're afraid, again, that those standards are going to be much weaker and not effective at dealing with the problem. So we're going to be having to work very hard to try to hold the line on this one.
And just to provide a little bit of historical context, I mean, this actually provides numeric nutrient criteria limits as opposed to what Florida had in place before, which was just sort of a written rule that many had considered very vague.
Well, that's why this pollution got out of control, is that we had something similar to like a drive slowly sign, and no one knew how right. Slow was slow enough. So now we have defined speed limits, and that's going to help us know how much is too much and to better control the pollution at its source, which is really what we're trying to accomplish.
And throughout the dialogue that's been, you know, going on about these water pollution issues in Florida, there's been some pretty vocal opposition from ranchers, agricultural farmers, other business interests that are in large part responsible for excess nutrient pollution like nitrogen and phosphorus getting into Florida's waterways. And of course, that opposition comes from what they say they would have to pay to change their practices and clean up the water. I'm wondering if, given the current economic climate and the recovering economy, you know, is this really the best time to put them in, I guess, put them under more of an economic burden, especially when we know that the governor's administration is heavily focused on growing and expanding business?
Well, we do know that we're going to pay one way or the other. I mean, we're paying in the form of lost revenues right now. The taxpayers are going to pay far more when they have to clean up the pollution after the fact than to prevent it. So it's really about cost distribution, making sure that those that are creating this type of pollution take on more responsibility for containing it and treating it on site so that taxpayers don't have to shoulder the full burden of trying to intercept it and clean it up after the fact, because that's far more expensive. That's exactly what we know out of Everglades restoration, and this, that it's far more expensive to remove this pollution once it's in our waterways than just to prevent it from getting in the first place. So that's what we're trying to do. And there is a lot of flexibility in the way this regulation is going to be applied. It literally allows decades for compliance. So, you know, it's not as if this is going to be unduly burdensome. It will ask people to take on more responsibility. And of course, that involves some more financial responsibility, but it does so in a very reasonable manner. And it has to be done if we're going to maintain our quality of life and attract people to come here to buy homes and to visit Florida.
Right. And the State Department of Agriculture and the University of Florida had projected that the cost on agriculture of implementing these numeric nutrient rules would be between $800 million and $3 billion initially and between $200 and $900 million annually. And they also estimated a loss of more than 7,000 agriculture jobs. On the other hand, I know that environmental restoration work has also created a great deal of jobs. So, I mean, is it about maybe kind of finding a balance?
Absolutely. I think there's jobs to be had either way, and it's just a matter of making decisions. We know that agriculture is very important to our state. We do believe that these standards are reasonable and can be financially handled by the agricultural industry. A lot of those cost estimates are based on assumptions that, frankly, we don't agree with, that we think are not accurate or show a thorough understanding of how these regulations are going to be implemented. There's so much flexibility, especially with regards to the agricultural community, in how these regulations are applied. And they have special concessions, if you will, in having to meet these. So if anything, we think that they are going to be less affected than some of the other stakeholders. And ultimately, if they don't pay to contain the pollution that they're generating, the taxpayers are going to pay. And that's our message, is that, you know, who is it more fair to saddle with these costs, and which policy will promote prevention of that pollution? And we believe by controlling it at its source and making those polluters responsible, that it will incentivize them to be more careful in how they apply fertilizer and the other types of things, waste products and things that generate this type of pollution.
Yeah, that's a good point, Jennifer. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but the EPA's own cost estimates on what that would cost agriculture were dramatically lower than what came out of that study from the Department of Agriculture. And one of the legal arguments that has been made against the initial lawsuit against the EPA, and that was that the EPA could not establish a cause and effect relationship between the in-stream concentrations of nutrients and negative impacts like these harmful algal blooms that we experience. Does that point have merit to you, or can we pretty much soundly say that we know this is the source of these problems further downstream?
Well, there's a lot of things that contribute to where that tipping point is. And I guess the difference of philosophy really lies as to whether there should be a margin of safety. EPA based its standards on looking at healthy water bodies, understanding that we didn't want to push things to the brink because likely they would go over the cliff and we would have to spend more money cleaning up those degraded water bodies. So what they were trying to do was base a standard that maintained health. And we thought that that was the right approach, rather than what the state has done, which is actually the complete opposite, which really allows the water body to become completely degraded and confirms, you have to confirm that it is biologically a failure before you actually set standards to control the pollution. And at that point, that reactive policy is going to cost us far more and is not going to incentivize prevention. So that to us actually is counter to what we were trying to accomplish with these standards.
Yeah, I can definitely see from your perspective folks scratching their heads, like, why do we have to destroy it to prove that it's bad? Let's go ahead and clean
exactly.
it up before
we When
destroy.
We see it degrading, we should catch it before it becomes that polluted. And that's what we're aiming to do, is to prevent the green slime outbreaks that right. cause us to close our water treatment plants and people to stay away from our waterways. We want to stop that from occurring.
Right, avoiding the mess in the first place as opposed to waiting and watching it get bad and then try to clean it up is going to take less resources and less effort and time. We are talking with Jennifer Hecker. She's state co-chair of the 28th Annual Everglades Coalition Conference, which kicks off tomorrow in Coral Gables. She's also Natural Resource Policy Director at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Give us a call and join the conversation. Studio lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Post your comments or questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or send email to golfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Jennifer, I wanted to touch just briefly on the issue of the pythons in the Everglades, the harmful invasive species that is there. And Florida Fish and Wildlife will be launching the first ever Python Challenge that's kicking off this weekend. And that's, of course, encouraging the public to learn more about this invasive species. And I know that updates on pythons in the Everglades, that'll be presented at the conference as well. But just overall, it's something that has gone national and international as a story. Yet issues like clean water, which are just as important, don't necessarily get all that much press. Why do you think that is?
Well, I definitely think that everyone doesn't like big, nasty, invasive snakes. So I think that's an issue that there's consensus on, and people generally find that to be an easy political lift to take on that issue. We're very happy that they've done that, and certainly, the efforts by Senator Nelson and some other key legislators to try to initiate legislation to restrict the importation of these invasive snakes is going to be incredibly helpful in trying to control this problem. So that's a very important problem, and we're glad that it's gotten the attention it deserves. We do wish that water quality and some of the other issues that are equally threatening to the Everglades would be attended to as the invasive snake issue, and we're working very hard to highlight those other issues.
And the 2013 state legislative session is just a couple of months away now. I was wondering, either from the perspective of the coalition or from the Conservancy, what are your priorities for the Everglades going into the session?
Well, we will be highlighting our 2013 legislative priorities for the Everglades Coalition, and those basically encompass three areas. One, providing adequate funding for Everglades restoration. We're asking the Florida legislature to restore former funding levels of $100 million annually. We feel that's absolutely imperative to make sure that we can implement Florida's recently adopted water quality plan and advance construction of vital Everglades projects. Secondly, we're also asking the legislature to promote responsible growth and transportation planning. We're not in a period of rapid growth right now. However, there's a lot of big planning efforts underway that could open up inland rural areas in the center of our state, which are the most environmentally sensitive areas we have left and very important for Everglades restoration, for water supply, and for wildlife. So we want to make sure that the legislature is aware of our concerns, making sure that we're planning for wildlife corridors, trying to limit sprawl, and make sure that all the planning efforts center around the effort to restore our Everglades. And then thirdly, we want to conserve and protect sufficient clean water. And numeric nutrient criteria is just one of many different regulatory changes with regards to water that is happening this year. It's probably the most important year in my professional career that I've seen with regards to water policy. And we're very concerned that some of these changes could be detrimental to stewarding our water resources. So we want to make sure that the legislature is aware of that and really promotes swimmable, fishable water quality, making sure that they promote water conservation and assure that Florida's water remains a public commodity.
And that's got to be a big thing for you. I know how vetted you are in these issues and in bringing these issues to light. So to say that 2013 could be that important, it's really saying a lot.
Yes, it really is. I mean, we had a monumental year a couple of years ago with regards to growth management, and there were a lot of, very important decisions made that will change the future of Florida. This is the year with regards to water resources, and we're very, very aware of that. The coalition is going to be very engaged, and you'll see that there'll be several panels and presentations throughout the conference focused on water resources because of our understanding of the policy changes that are afoot.
In his first year in office, Governor Rick Scott put $17 million towards Everglades restoration. That's a far cry from the $100 to $200 million allocated to the Florida Forever program that we saw under Governor Bush's administration. But then in the session under his second year in office, that funding was bumped up to $40 million. And that was even in the face of a multi-billion dollar budget deficit. So given that we're looking at a projected surplus going into this session this year, are you hopeful to garner more money for Everglades projects this year?
Well, we're certainly going to try. It's very, very important to get that land conservation money because we have to offer landowners an alternative. Those who have very environmentally sensitive lands or areas that are important for restoration, for public use, we have to offer them a viable alternative to recognize and compensate them for the value of their land. And that is our vehicle to do that. And if we don't have funds in there, then we can't adequately do that. So we'll be working very closely with the governor's office to try to promote his request for Florida Forever and perhaps even advocate for more, depending on what that request ultimately is.
And the Department of the Interior has taken the lead on a partnership initiative to either purchase some of those large parcels of environmentally important land from private landowners or to work with them through conservation easements to sort of maintain the environmental integrity of that property, even as it stays under private ownership. How pivotal is working cooperatively with these private landowners to a good land conservation program?
It's essential. I mean, most of our land conservation effort programs are centered around willing landowners. So we have to have them cooperative because otherwise we wouldn't even have that opportunity to purchase their land. And we are working with them to explore a variety of mechanisms. Where they want to continue farming or ranching activities, there is the option of just purchasing easements, which would hold some of those environmental values but allow them continued use of their property. So there's a continuum of conservation options on the table, and we just need to make sure we have funding available to implement those.
And you had mentioned just before we went live that Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is going to be at the conference this year.
Yes, we're really excited that he will be here in person. And we feel very fortunate to have him be giving a speech at the conference, as well as the Assistant Secretary of the Army, Joellen Darcy. So we're going to have some very notable attendees and presenters, also Senator Bob Graham. Perhaps Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, we understand, might be in attendance. So we are looking forward to a very successful conference this year.
And you know, we've seen some what seems like promising moves coming from Washington when it comes to the Everglades recently. I think it was just last week, Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart and Alcee Hastings, in a bipartisan move, announced the reintroduction of the Congressional Everglades Caucus. And as the co-chairs, they say that caucus will educate members of the new 113th Congress on issues related to the Everglades. Do you think that caucus could have much impact on the national level? And do you perhaps anticipate working with the caucus in the future?
Absolutely. We need that type of leadership in Washington. We are in desperate need of what's known as a Water Resources Development Act. That's what authorizes Everglades projects to continue. While we have projects already in the ground and moving ahead, we need authorization for those next phase of projects. And without leadership in Washington to help us get one of these bills passed, we will not have that. So we are very excited about them reinitiating the Everglades Caucus, and we'll be working closely with them to support their efforts.
And I wanted to look just briefly at some of the successes that we've seen in terms of Everglades restoration projects. The Tamiami Trail Bridge project to sort of restore that natural flowway through Everglades National Park. I know that was initially slated for completion sometime this year, and that's been more than 20 years in the making. Do you know if that's still on schedule for completion this year?
I believe so. And I think we were really excited last year in 2012 to get additional congressional authorization for additional bridging. So, you know, this is just phase one. That 1 mile is the beginning of something spectacular, which is to restore natural sheet flow into the Everglades National Park under the Tamiami Trail. And that's going to be incredibly important for then re-diverting flows that are currently now going to the Coosawhatchee, which can be very harmful, down south. Because right now, we don't have the capacity to put more water south, and our estuaries are being degraded as a result. But with this trail being raised, it's going to actually affect us here in Southwest Florida by allowing us to put more water back where it belongs.
And speaking of restoration projects right here in Southwest Florida, I was hoping we could talk just a little bit about the Picayune Strand Project. I think another great example of the importance of working with private landowners there. But how has that project been coming along? Are we still seeing success in terms of, you know, native wildlife returning?
Yes. On the West Coast, we did break ground and have been restoring the Picayune Strand in Collier County. That's 85 square miles of natural flow into the 10,000 Islands region. It's one of the most spectacular restoration projects in the Everglades suite of projects. And it has had already impacts to particularly panthers. We've been able to document panthers utilizing that area. It will help the water supply in Collier County in the future. More fresh water storage like this, which is occurring on the rehydration of Picayune Strand, is going to help grow that water pie that will allow us to maintain our quality of life and sustain our current communities and also allow for future growth.
We're taking a closer look at efforts to conserve and restore the Florida Everglades with Jennifer Hecker. She's state co-chair of the 28th Annual Everglades Coalition Conference beginning tomorrow. And I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. If you have a question for Jennifer, our number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Jennifer, I don't want to end on a sour note here, but I just wanted to highlight something. Last week, we saw some new results in the South Florida Wading Bird Report, which indicates nesting among diving and wading birds in South Florida was down for the third consecutive year. And a spokesman for the South Florida Water Management District told the news press that in addition to uncooperative weather over the past couple years, it's really the loss of shallow wetland habitat that's been playing a big role in nesting numbers being down. And the worst losses among the worst losses they found, I think, were among the endangered wood stork. And that species, South Florida nesting activity is down 44% below the 10-year average, even as federal officials are considering downgrading the protected status of the bird because of gains that are being made in other states. And I heard from Jason Lordson at the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary that they haven't nested there in, I think, 5 of the last 6 years, and this season's looking like a wash as well. Aren't birds like the wood stork and these other wading birds indicator species when it comes to the health of the Everglades? I mean, what does this down nesting activity sort of indicate to you?
Well, it really speaks to the urgency of why we need this timely restoration to occur. We have wading bird populations down 90% across the board, across the Everglades ecosystem. You know, the Everglades is a UNESCO list World Heritage Site, and it's recognized as being endangered. It's the nation's largest restoration project. It is a national and international importance. And it really is what attracts tourists to our state. It's one of those key iconic features that people come to Florida to visit, to see. And we are very concerned. You know, these are indicators of Everglades in decline. And that is all the more reason that we need renewed commitment and to accelerate the momentum of Everglades restoration, and why we have the conference to bring together those state, federal stakeholders as well as the public stakeholders to figure out how can we advance this in a more timely fashion, because we are losing resources daily and we want to make sure that we have something at the end of the day, you know, that warrants the investment. And we'll have the water supply, but the wildlife is a great concern. We want to make sure we get there before it's too late, because they have dropped significantly.
When it comes to, you know, costs and other environmental impacts, how could a healthy Everglades ecosystem perhaps help mitigate the impacts of sea level rise?
Well, it's incredibly important for South Florida. South Florida being very low-lying, having a high water table, we're incredibly vulnerable to sea level rise. And what we have is a situation where fresh water keeps the seawater at bay. So when you don't have enough fresh water pushing outward, it accelerates the ability of seawater to intrude inward. And it can intrude both through our surface waters, but also into our groundwater, into our aquifers, which we rely upon for our drinking water. So it's incredibly important that we keep that bubble of fresh water full and pushing outward. And that's what Everglades restoration is going to allow us to do.
You know, earlier in the conversation, we were talking pretty heavily about nutrient pollution standards in Florida waterways. Does that set specific criteria for nitrogen or just phosphorus?
It would set for both.
Okay.
And that's very important, because phosphorus is a very important pollution factor to deal with fresh waters. But in marine waters, you are more concerned about nitrogen. Well, the nitrogen is coming from inland. So if you don't control it inland, by the time it reaches the coastal waters, it's really too much of a problem to deal with. And we want to make sure that we are taking on this problem holistically, dealing with pollution at its source. So that means that we need these both standards throughout the entire state. And that's what the EPA had been pushing and we're going to continue to support ultimately happens.
And I wanted to ask also just about the conference in general. It seems like this is really something designed for for stakeholders like policymakers and environmental advocates and researchers. Is there something that, you know, the general public can take from this as well?
We have tried to really offer a variety of different presentations and opportunities for every type of participant. So there are Everglades 101 sessions for people who are from the general public who don't know much so that they can feel comfortable, get in there and understand what the problems are, what they can do to help our efforts. So it is not going to be limited just to scientists or governmental agency folk or environmental policy professionals like myself. It's really going to be something where we're going to have many students I know in attendance and many general public participants as well. And we're trying to plan and accommodate for that to make sure that it's not too techy or wonky, that it really offers a variety of educational experiences for our participants.
Do any of the other stakeholders get involved as well? And I'm thinking of, you know, maybe even some of these farmers that we talked about earlier or the commercial fishing industry, because, of course, water with high nutrient levels in it is going to create more problems with algal blooms, which would impact them. We've been experiencing here in Southwest Florida these red tide blooms off and on in recent weeks. So we see the impact. I think more than 4.5 tons of dead fish were removed from Sarasota beaches just a couple weeks ago. That, of course, comes at a significant cost. Do you hear from some of these folks too?
Well, some of those folks are actually members of the coalition. We have the Snook and Game Fish Foundation as a member, the Reef Relief. There's a number of groups in our coalition that are actually, groups that represent those stakeholders. But we reach out to everyone, and we will have some participants, you know, that represent other entities, the industry side of things, and we welcome them to come to the conference. We always try to make sure that it's inclusive so that we can further dialogue. And inversely, we try to attend their conferences. It's important that we continue to listen to one another and try to work together collaboratively to solving these problems. And so we do not want to shut out people who have opposing points of view. We welcome them to join in and have a conversation with us so we can try to figure out what are the solutions.
Right. Well, and when you look at other environmental restoration projects going on throughout the nation on this large scale, is Everglades restoration still leading the way?
Yes, it still is the nation's largest restoration project. It is, a $10.9 billion project. It's incredibly large. We do now recognize that there are a number of other large-scale projects throughout the country, the Great Lakes, Chesapeake Bay, Mississippi. There's a number of other large-scale restoration efforts underway. And I think a lot of times when we go to D.C., the perception is that we're farther along than we really are, that, oh, didn't the Everglades, didn't that already get restored? Mm. And, you know, why are we continuing to talk about it? It's time to move on to other things. Unfortunately, we haven't finished that project. We have about half of the land to date for those restoration projects under public ownership. We still have a long way to go, and we need to highlight that. This is such a large-scale project. It's going to take literally decades, and we want to make sure that we can sustain that public support and that support from Congress and from our state to see this through and finish this successfully, because it is a model. It's a precedent for all other restoration projects to come.
Well, that is all the time, unfortunately, we have for this portion of the program. But I want to thank my guest, Jennifer Hecker. She's state co-chair of the 28th Annual Everglades Coalition Conference beginning Thursday in Coral Gables. The event brings together stakeholders from across the spectrum for a look at Everglades restoration, including successes, challenges, risks, and opportunities. Information about the conference is at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live, or you can also, what is the website for the coalition there as well?
EvergladesCoalition.org.
Perfect. And information there as well. And when we return from this break, nanotechnology, human experiments, and the risks of a largely unregulated industry. That's the crux of the medical thriller from novelist, physician, and Naples resident Robin Cook. Just ahead, WGCU's Amy Tardiff sits down with the author for a look at his latest novel, Nano. Stay with us.